Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
Think about the last time you were at the supermarket. Your cart is packed with groceries, you've checked your list, so you turn your attention to the checkout lines. Yes, the checkout lines, perhaps the most dreaded part of the trip to the store. It seems like no matter which one you try and squeeze in, it slows down. Someone's fumbling with coins, even writing a check. Why does it seem like you can't choose the right lane? It turns out there's a mathematical explanation for this, just like there's a mathematical explanation for why that green Romanesco broccoli in your cart looks so beautiful, and why all the Brazil nuts seem to have risen to the top of your box of trail mix. This is Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. And here to explain the math behind our everyday decisions is Raphael Rosen. He's a science writer and author of the new book, Math Geek, From Klein Bottles to Chaos Theory, A Guide to the Nerdiest Math Facts, Theorems, and Equations. Raphael, thanks for welcome to Think.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Since I've already teased the math behind long lines, let's start there. Do I just have bad luck, or is there more going on?
There is actually more happening there. In, I guess, normal lines, it's very easy to be caught behind someone who is, as you said, counting change or writing a check. There are other sorts of lines. They are known as serpentine lines, and you've probably seen them at places like either Whole Foods markets or at maybe banks as well. And in those lines, there's one long line in which everybody waits, and at the very end, you are sent to the next available register. In this kind of system, there's never a chance that one slow person can hold up a long line. At all times, you can be directed to a newly opened register.
Uh-huh. And I saw that there's even people who study this. They're called queuing theorists.
That is right. Their job is to study the mathematics behind lines and waiting in them.
It's a funny profession to have, but I guess it's an important thing to study. And you get to talk about serpentine lines as well.
Exactly.
Which sounds fun. So you're saying that the lines that we see at banks are very different, or function very different than the ones we see at Walmart or Kroger's, because you can be redirected to mini tellers.
That's right. They're much more efficient in that way. You are never held behind someone who is extra slow.
Yeah. So this book covers a lot of ground, and they're in nice, tiny 2 to 3 page installments. You've broken it down into sections, starting with shapes and then behaviors and then patterns and finally special numbers. And we'll start a little bit with shapes. Shapes are the most obviously, to me at least, connected to math. You know, drawing a cube gives me flashbacks to geometry class.
Right. I've always been very interested in shapes. I think, let's see, I took geometry in high school in the 9th grade, and I always liked how the mathematics in that maybe subfield felt more, I guess, tangible and more hands-on. It felt more real than X's and Y's and Z's. There is a lot in the mathematical world involving shapes.
And one you talk about that was fascinating was bubbles, something you see all the time, kids playing with bubbles or bubbles in the bath. But this is a special shape?
Right. Well, there has been research done on one, whether a single bubble is the most efficient way to enclose a certain amount of volume, whether air or water or maybe jello or anything else, really. And it was shown, I think, in the 80s or 90s that yes, that shape is the most efficient way. But then there was further research, and if you've ever seen, I guess, two or more bubbles mushed into one, like if you've ever seen two, for example, there where they meet is a flat kind of boundary or membrane, and there has been thought about whether that sort of shape is the best way to enclose
space,
two volumes,
space. Huh.
right, and there was eventually a proof showing that yes, that actually is the best way.
Why would we care what the best way to enclose two volumes are?
Well, some of mathematics is not immediately maybe usable, but it has its own intrinsic power and interest, it's always worthwhile studying for its own sake.
Huh. I did see, and I don't know, like you're saying, sometimes the discoveries that people make take much longer to find actual applications. I know that's the case even with something as random as here it was invented, I think, in Plano, Gorilla Glue, for example, or Gorilla Glass, which was invented, and it took many, many years to realize, oh, what can we do with this extra strong glass? And of course, now it's ubiquitous. But I wonder with this bubble idea, whether we'll find a use for it, the double bubble, beyond blowing bubbles later on.
Right. I mean, there's a chance, say, that it might find a use in the design of maybe spacecraft or submarines. It's hard to say now, but math has a way of showing up in unexpected places.
Also, you talk about another shape, or at least a shape that a lot of us draw. If you're going to draw someone crying, or if you're going to draw some rain in the sky, most kids and adults, myself included, when I draw a raindrop, I usually draw it in that tear shape, that sort
right.
of oval. But you say that's wrong.
Yeah, that's actually wrong. The shape of a raindrop is actually more or less a sphere. Though, as it falls faster and faster and faster, the air that it hits, like on its bottom, will actually flatten that sphere more into like the shape of a hamburger bun, and then at a certain speed and size, that shape will then split into two.
So it's sort of like what starts out as a droplet becomes this top of the hamburger bun, if you can imagine that, and then it splits in the middle into two droplets.
That's exactly right, yes.
So I'm going to have to start drawing it that way, and everyone's going to think that I don't know how to draw now.
Right.
It's very unfortunate, but I'll tell them it's mathematically correct, and maybe they'll forgive me.
Yes.
Another shape question is about golf balls. I have to admit, I always thought that the dimples on golf balls were just, I don't know, for looks or decoration.
Yeah, no, actually, it's much more than that. That shape helps the golf ball fly farther and more accurately. It so happens that as the ball flies through the air gets kind of sucked into those small little spaces, and that means that the air stays much, much closer to the surface of the golf ball, which then means that there is less drag that holds the ball back as it flies. Less drag means that it can fly faster and with less wobbling.
So why wouldn't we do that if that's the case, that the dimples actually make the golf ball more streamlined, I guess? Why wouldn't they do that with a soccer ball or a basketball?
Well, you know, I'm not exactly sure. My thought is that probably golf balls have to fly for much, much longer distances at much higher speeds. And so therefore, there is a much higher need for accurate path. While a soccer ball is, it moves at a much, 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 much slower speed, and there's much more room for mistakes.
But you do say that soccer balls have a special shape, I guess, as well, right?
They do. If you look at one, they are made up of a sort of quilt of both hexagons and also pentagons. And they form this very, very interesting sphere-like shape that is made up of many, many other shapes.
How is that different than something like this Romanesco broccoli? You describe broccoli, which looks like one piece is repeated many, many times to create a larger head of broccoli, so to speak.
Well, that's interesting. I would say a soccer ball is, in a way, more like, I guess, a tessellation, like in which there is a repeating series of shapes that that most likely cover a plane or field, whereas the broccoli shape, it's more like a fractal, like in which if you look at, say, a tree, you'll notice that the same basic kind of branching shape shows up at large scales and at small scales. So for instance, the shape of the tree seen from maybe 40 feet away looks very much like the shape of a small twig. And that's what happens that sort of broccoli, that its shape actually is mirrored in the shapes of its smaller surface cones.
So that's why they're so good at looking like little trees also.
That's right, yes.
Which is always good for playtime. So that you see that, is that true also with other natural features you might find in a forest, like a pine cone?
Not so much a pine cone, but you might see it in clouds, or you could even see fractal shapes in the shape of a maybe coastline, where, like, if you looked at the shape of a coast from maybe 1 mile out in space, it would look more or less the same as like if you looked at it from a foot or so away. That shape would repeat itself. That's right. It shows up over and over again.
Great. We're talking today with Raphael Rosen. He's author of the new book, Math Geek, From Klein Bottles to Chaos Theory. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverWoman. We'll be back with more after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest is Raphael Rosen. He's author of the new book, Math Geek, From Klein Bottles to Chaos Theory, A Guide to the Nerdiest Math Facts, Theorems, and Equations.
All right, Raphael, you say Google Translate has to do with mathematics.
Bien, Rafael, dices Google Traducir tiene que ver con las matemáticas.
That was little Google Translate trying to ask you a question. You say Google Translate has to do with math. How so?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's a sort of program that does not rely on the meanings of words per se or even the grammar. It's not using a dictionary. It uses something called machine translation. It searches through a virtual database of around 80 languages, and it tries to find which sentences of one language are more likely to be the right translations of those in another language.
Huh. So it uses, I mean, it doesn't seem as reliable as a calculator, I'll tell you that much. When I tried to type in some sentences and convert them to Spanish, it took a few different tries of wording it to try and get something that was actually accurate.
Right. It uses odds and mostly odds to figure out what is the right translation. It's not as if it is a language student that is using a book.
I see.
It uses statistics, actually.
Huh. And why, if I'm using Google Translate, why does it matter if I know that it's using statistics or that math is involved in spitting out that translation?
I would say it's an example of using an algorithm, a set pathway of moving from one affair state up to another. It's a set of rules almost.
But why is it? Why should I care? I guess is my question.
It shows the power of mathematics to solve these very, very thorny, very, very thorny problems. It's very hard to teach a machine to translate languages. But it's very easy for like a machine to use a search function as this program does.
Huh. And it's fun to use and try, but I guess it seems like it has some glitches that it needs to be worked out.
True.
When you use programs like Google Translate or, I don't know, I imagine the Weather Channel's predictions, you're looking at that. Are you thinking about math while you're using this stuff?
Me personally, no. I just like to know how this program actually works. I think that's a very interesting bit of knowledge to have, to know how something that seems very, very simple, like, is actually not.
Uh-huh. Now, music also is of course built on math, which is sort of funny because I think a lot of musicians might not consider themselves mathematicians as well. Are they?
In a sense, they are. Mathematics is a major component of music. I was built into the, into music's very fabric. In a song, say, there is a set number of how many beats there are in each measure, and there is a set number of or there is
the set
value for how long each note should be held. So there are numbers all inside it throughout.
Yeah. And groups don't have to write a song in crazy sort of time sequences for it to be different either, because so many of the songs run on the same time signatures. One of the most well-known songs with an unusual rhythm is Dave Brubeck's Take Five jazz song. Do you think that musicians are playing with math consciously, or is this something that's going on and they just like the way it sounds?
That's a good question. I would guess that they just like how it sounds. I'm not sure, but I think that it's more to do with the sound and the beat, and also the rhythm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's another one of the songs that I really like that's a strange time signature is Outkast's Hey Ya, which is actually some odd time signature that everyone apparently abbreviates to 11-4, which, as I'm neither a mathematician nor a musician, so it's sort of difficult for me to understand, but I like to dance to it.
Right.
So you also point out in the music field that there's math, something in a place I never would have thought about, and it's something called change ringing. Explain what this is. It sounds like bells in perhaps a church.
Right. That's actually where it often happens. It it involves a maybe series of bells. It's like either six or seven or eight, usually. And all the bells are rung in a certain order. It is called a row or a change. And in that row, no bell is rung more than one time. But as the rows each bell
there's different
move
combinations.
Slots by one. Right. So it may start at 1, 2, 3, 4 and then move to 1, 3, 2, 4 and then move to 1, 3, 4, 2 and then 3, 1, 4, 2 and then always the rows end at the original row, which is 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, okay. So there's lots of combinations. I mean, if you have 10 bells or, I don't know, something like that, how many about combinations might there be?
You would have to multiply, 10 times 9 times 8 times 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1. I don't have...
Yeah, that would be a...
I calculated here, but it's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. So it can go on for a long time with, if you paid attention, you wouldn't ever hear that, the repeat.
That is right, yes.
It's funny. Now I'm going to listen to bell tolling in a whole new way.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about behavior and mathematics. And one feature in your book that, of course, speaks to us here in Texas and North Texas is about traffic and how we drive in traffic. There's a conundrum you talk about where building more roads actually can create more traffic or make traffic worse.
Right. This was a feature that was first noticed in the late 1960s. And what a math a and what researchers noticed was that as more roads were built, the like it's harder and harder to drive on them. They are more and more clogged. So like if there is one road added that is maybe meant to be a faster shortcut road, at that point, all the drivers will want to take that road, and then
That
and then
shortcut.
that's right, and then there will be a major traffic jam.
So everyone wants to go the shortest route. So even if
That's right.
you build a new short route, it doesn't mean that everyone will evenly split between the new short route and the old route. Is that sort of?
That's exactly right, yes.
So, and this is a big issue here in North Texas. We're looking at the planned Trinity Toll Road. And it's funny because I looked and saw a federal study did show that worse congestion on freeway routes used by some southern Dallas residents. This is an area it was supposed to perhaps help. So maybe this really does affect real life. It's not just a theory.
Oh yes, all the time. This like there was a study in Seoul, I think, in that once a major highway was removed from its downtown area, traffic actually was much more streamlined.
Yeah, well, something to consider for freeway planners, definitely, and city planners. How does this relate, or does it, to buses bunching, another public transportation issue that is very, very frustrating for anyone who's tried to catch a bus, and you wait and you wait and you wait and you stand there and you don't see anything, and you finally see a bus, and then behind it you see three more of the same exact bus line, same buses that are coming.
Right. Yeah, that's that happens all the time. And like if you think about it, that first bus will stop at one of its bus stops, and let's say that there is a long line of people waiting to get on the bus. They will actually slow that first bus down, and that means that like at that at its next stop,
There might be more people who have to wait to get off.
that's right. And then at the same time, the following bus will notice fewer and fewer waiting people, and so therefore, it'll go faster and faster and faster, and then it will he eventually meet that first bus.
So it will actually pass up the if I imagine if you're driving, then the first bus may end up being the slowest, and the other buses will actually go around it and go ahead of it.
That's right, yes.
So how do you avoid that? Is there any advice for people taking buses?
That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure. This happens to all to all metro systems. I'm not sure that there is actually a fix. There have been plans to make bus only lanes, which helps maybe somewhat, but I think it's a part of having a bus system.
Now, math is also found throughout art. And I remember, as we look back to high school and all the other math classes, I also remember in art class in photography learning the rule of thirds in how to take photos that are supposed to be more attractive. I don't know if it helped, but in any case, I remember that. And I also remember learning about something you talk about, the golden ratio. What makes the golden ratio special for art?
It's actually found in many, many artwork throughout history, one of which is, gosh, The Last Supper. One is the Sistine Chapel. And it's just more or less a ratio between numbers. It's 1 to 1.618. And that ratio shows up in many, many kinds of artworks. Some researchers think that it is planned, and some think that it is not, that it is more accidental.
It's so fascinating. I looked at some of these photos that you're talking about in the Sistine Chapel, and the one of you see the famous photo of also the creation where Adam is reaching out to touch the finger of God, and it's right at that line where their two hands meet that is this, you can see this golden ratio. So it's
right.
But I guess we don't know whether that was planned or accidental.
That's right. It's known that it is a very, it is a ratio that makes very pleasing shapes, but it's not known whether that is done on purpose.
Interesting. You're listening to Think on 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd, and we're talking today with Raphael Rosen. He's author of the new book, Math Geek, From Klein Bottles to Chaos Theory, A Guide to the Nerdiest Math Facts, Theorems, and Equations. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 800-933-5372. That's 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from Raphael Rosen after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. Our guest is science writer Raphael Rosen. He's author of the book Math Geek, From Klein Bottles to Chaos Theory, A Guide to the Nerdiest Math Facts, Theorems, and Equations. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. Raphael, you spent almost a decade working at the Exploratorium, which is San Francisco's hands-on museum, which I love. I grew up in that area, and I definitely thought it was a good museum. What have you seen, or when you worked there, that got kids interested in math?
Well, it's a very, very good place to learn about math. My very favorite was an exhibit that was called Wave Upon Wave. It showed how sine waves would actually mush in and form like a new larger or a new smaller wave. And it showed that notion in a very kind of graphical way. In a way that involved movable metal bars and metal hand cranks. It was a very hands-on way to learn about math, and in my opinion, that actually is a very good way to show kids that math is is not just something that is like in schools or on tests, but it is found in our world, in unexpected places.
And do you think that it's cooler or at least more acceptable today to be into math than it was when you were growing up?
I would think so. There is much more math in I guess popular culture than there used to be. Like, I'm thinking of shows like maybe Numbers. There was a play called Proof. I think right now math is definitely very, very cool and very hip.
Yeah, it is. And everything, like you said, from Mythbusters and Futurama to The Big Bang Theory. And I've been watching recently Halt and Catch Fire, which is both programming and also math accessible, I guess you could say.
Right.
Were you always interested in math?
Yeah, I have never been a math expert, but I have always been a math fan or math maybe groupie. Like, there was always like in my household growing up, I had a book that was called 1, 2, 3 Infinity, and like in it it had a story of like having wheat placed on squares on a chessboard, and it showed how if you double the amount of wheat like on each square, like you would soon have an just it was just an enormous number of wheat grains. It was always very, very fascinating how a very, 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 very simple procedure could lead to this huge, huge number.
Yeah, that some of those books can just be perplexing, and some kids will really get into them. A woman in Dallas, Cayenne, says she has a 7-year-old who's always quizzing her on mathematics in the car. She tells him that she needs paper to do the problems. What are some of your favorite math-related podcasts or, I don't know, car activities or activities in general for doing with kids?
I think probably maybe start by like adding up numbers on license plates. I mean, like it's very, very easy to do, and they are all over the place.
Well, that's a good one to do, especially on a long road trip.
Right.
I just sat in the back seat and made faces at the people behind me. But I guess I could add up the number that was on their right license plate and show it to them and see if they had any idea what I was talking about.
Right.
So there's also someone wrote in about practical uses for mathematics. Earlier we were talking about the bubble and how efficient the double bubble is and how sometimes mathematicians might not know what that will come in handy for later on. And Tom writes, seemingly obscure mathematical discoveries often find a practical use long after their discovery. One example is knot theory. Mathematicians learned how different knots were formed, but no one had a practical use for this knowledge. And years later, he says, biologists researching how viruses replicated relied on knot theory to help solve this puzzle. It's fascinating. Have you heard about this?
Yes, I knots are a very interesting mathematical entity, and you think of your headphone cords and how they are often knotted and tangled. Actually, there is a mathematical reason for that. A study that was done at UC San Diego showed that it only takes one end of a knot to cross over or like a string to cross that string's length to start a knot from happening. And so it's much more likely that a string or a cord will knot than knot.
Then not knot.
Right.
I see. That's, yeah, it's endlessly frustrating to look at my phone cords and my headphone cords. But I've seen that it's helpful to put fabric around it if you buy the cords that have that are lined with fabric.
I'm not sure that I have seen those.
Yeah, I don't know what the mathematical explanation is for that, but it seems to help. You also point out in the book that kids are immersed in math all the time, even when they're watching Pixar movies like Brave or Inside Out. How so?
In the animation process, an animator has to break down a shape into maybe smaller shapes like cubes or others. And then once that those shapes are then made into, say, a person's face, there is a mathematical formula that's used to smooth out the edges so it looks more natural.
Huh, yeah, you say it's they pioneered this mathematical technique for making sharp edges smooth, which definitely makes things look more lifelike and has that, I guess, signature Pixar stamp on it.
Right.
And kids, I like that. My parents told me they were going to see some Pixar movies, so it's not just for kids either.
Right.
And do you think about that stuff when you're watching movies, or what gets you curious about math?
That's a good question. Like, I would say that it's the abstract thought. It's there is a sort of beauty to mathematics that is not found in other places. In shapes and in proofs, there is something there that is very appealing to the human mind, I think.
Huh. Now, you have some practical advice as well in this book about math, about staying dry in the rain, for example. Can you solve that with math?
There are many ways to maybe think about it. One is to run and avoid as many drops as you can. And one is to walk slowly and therefore run into as few drops as you can. And there are researchers on both sides, in my reading, I found that it helps to run.
Really? That's what
Right.
I don't know. I never understood, I guess, the slow walking idea either, because it just felt like I was spending more time in the rain.
True.
But or just get an umbrella is another solution for that. So social media, you say, that art jealousy when it comes to social media, there's actually mathematical roots to that.
Right. There actually have been studies that show that it is true that your friends on social media are happier and have more money and more friends than you have. In every friend or social network, there is one friend or maybe two friends who is more, I would say, liked than other friends are, and therefore has more friends in their networks. And so it's much more likely for you to be in their network than not.
Interesting. So it's a product or example of sampling bias, that since your set of friends on Facebook, for example, it's already biased towards people who have friends in the first place.
Right. That's right. Exactly.
So, and this happens a lot in polling. Also, you know, when you go out or I don't know, you ask someone to call in and give their opinion about something, that's where you see sampling bias too, right?
That is also true. You have to be careful about who you sample and where, and even what you ask them.
You have a few math-based test-taking strategies, which could come in handy for anyone who's still in school or taking tests in general. What do you suggest?
Well, like in school, like I haven't heard that it helps to always choose C in multiple choice tests. But actually, that is not the best solution, because most teachers have heard that too. So, usually, if all the questions are worth the same, it helps to answer as many as you can, and not to spend a large amount of time on any one of them, but to move through as fast like as you can.
You're listening to Think on 90.1. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is Raphael Rosen. He's a science writer and author of the new book, Math Geek, From Klein Bottles to Chaos Theory, A Guide to the Nerdiest Math Facts, Theorems, and Equations. Raphael, thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Lauren Silverman. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day.